Hello and welcome to National League Town, Mets fandom, Mets history, Mets life, with Long Island's own Greg Prince and Jeff Heisen. Hey, Greg.
Greetings from a victorious National League clubhouse, Jeff, or the remains thereof in Seattle.
On today's show, we look ahead to the resumption of the regular season, and we look back at All-Star Week. But first, the National League won. The National League won the All-Star game, or at least we think they did. People wearing weird clothes did, right, Greg?
I honestly couldn't tell for most of the nine innings which team I was supposed to be rooting for, because I was looking for players maybe in their road uniforms from the National League playing in an American League ballpark. But all I saw was dark shirts and dark pants, and had to remember how they related to the forest green shirts and white pants. I think pants that aren't super dark make a lot of difference, because I probably could have figured it out after about three innings, but I just kept forgetting, to be honest, who was national and who was American, even though it says on the uniforms now, national and American. But yeah, the team wearing the dark jerseys and the god-awful dark pants was the National League. And for the first time since 2012, the National League, the league whose banner we carry here at National League Town, they finally won an All-Star game, just like, God save us from this expression, but just like it used to be, just like we liked it when we were younger. NL3, AL2, thank you, catcher from Colorado.
Elias Diaz with the two-run homer to win it. Yeah, the uniform issue seems to have come up, and you discussed this a few weeks ago on the show when you said, why can't they just wear their regular uniforms? Numerous people said that, so you were ahead of the curve on that. I know MLB wants to sell unique uniforms, but these were unique, certainly in a bad way.
I'm not looking to add them to my collection, such as it is. I guess they reached some conclusion some years ago where they had batting practice jerseys of this nature, but for the game, they would wear their actual jerseys. And I know they sold, I would think, plenty of the batting practice jerseys, because I've seen them around every year back when the Mets would have lots of All-Stars, especially. People would snap up those special jerseys to show that David Wright made the All-Star team, or that Matt Harvey made the All-Star team, or Jacob deGrom, and so forth. And now they've sort of flipped that script. So, yeah, I suppose somebody has bought a Pete Alonso dark blue jersey, or a Kodai Senga dark blue jersey, Kodai having been a last-minute addition to the team. So we did have multiple All-Stars, which is nice. But again, this is kind of one of those Brigadoon things where I think we're going to forget about it very quickly and then be reminded all over again as if we didn't see it coming next summer that we loved. And when I say we, I mean fans, because I don't think it's just our private complaint. Fans love to see their team represent that allegiance by coming out in those uniforms, whether it was their home uniform or their away uniform. And they would tip a cap and we would applaud, and whatever happened in the game happened. But more homogeny for Major League Baseball. That seems to be something Rob Manfred wants to promote. And there must be some bottom line payoff here that we're not seeing, because we don't want anything to do with it. But we're baseball fans. We watched the game and we were happy with the result.
What got me even more than the uniforms were the hats, those cream color hats. The Mets are blue and orange. That really bothered me, seeing Pete in that cream colored hat.
Yeah, one of Pete's at bats, I didn't realize Pete was batting, because, you know, they don't really tell you who's batting during the game because they're too busy having conversations with their pre-game hosts during the game, or maybe they've got somebody mic'd up. So something as silly as a batter coming to the plate in a one-run game late in the game doesn't really get their attention. And I hear something, something, Pete Alonso, something, something. Oh, Pete's up again. That would have been nice to have been on top of, I guess, if I were keeping a scorecard at home, as all good baseball fans should be doing during the All-Star game. I would have been absolutely on top of it. But they weren't presenting any cues. And, you know, it was good enough for Pete to wear his Mets uniform in the home run derby. I don't know why that couldn't be carried all the way to the next day, but it seemed like they had hats and jerseys and pants, more wardrobe changes than Janet Jackson had in the Super Bowl halftime show 20 years ago. The more clothes these guys wear, I guess the more clothes there's a chance to sell. And I look forward to the ratings coming out, because the ratings will probably show this was the least watched All-Star game ever, because it's always the least watched All-Star game ever. And I'm coming to the conclusion that, you know what the All-Star game should be? It should be like the Tonys. The Tonys are a pretty, shall we say, flamboyant presentation. These are theater people being theater people. And some I used to watch the Tonys and think to myself, well, I don't know how this is playing in Middle America, because it's very New Yorkish in a certain way. And then I realized, you know what? Let them be. Let the people who put on the Tonys be as theatrical as they like to be. Let the movie people put on the Oscars the way they really want it to be. Give them 4.5 hours to pat themselves on the back. And give baseball fans back the All-Star game with players wearing their jerseys, wearing their caps. And should we go to a 10th inning? Let them keep playing. Because last night, it seemed to me that the first thing the announcer said after the NL went ahead 3-2 was, hey, maybe the AL can tie it up and we can have that extra home run derby that we'll have in case of a tie. Because these days, God forbid, you should have normal extra innings even in the regular season. And fortunately, thanks to spiritual Met closer Craig Kimbrel, who reminded me of every tight ninth inning from John Franco through the not great greatest days of Jerry's Familia. Craig Kimbrel did not give away the game. Bent but did not break, and we were spared extra innings. But you know what? There is some formula in the commissioner's office, in the Fox boardroom when Fox isn't doing nefarious things. And they think this is better somehow, as opposed to just saying, let's put on an all-star game that baseball fans like, and baseball fans will watch it, and we'll figure out a way to get more baseball fans the rest of the year.
And non-baseball fans are not going to tune in and go, boy, they're wearing those cool uniforms and those cream-colored hats. I'm going to start watching baseball. How about doing this for the baseball fan who is actually watching? And what also bothered me there was the way, as you said, Joe Davis and Smoltz, who I can't stand. Smoltz is I'm biased against him because of his Brave leanings, but he's just so bad at his job. He's not even close to how good Ron Darling is. The only time they showed an interest in the game, as you said, was when it was 3-2 because they were rooting for the American League to tie it so they could have the home run derby to decide the result.
You know, I'd rather watch John Smoltz in his prime pitch against the Mets, which you'll recall usually meant the Mets were not in good shape. But I'd rather watch John Smoltz, the pitcher, against my team than have to listen to John Smoltz drone on during any kind of baseball game with any kind of stakes to it. And of course, the All-Star game has no stakes to it. So, yeah, he's become unlistenable. Joe Davis, I could take or leave. But other than a couple of pre-taped packages that were sort of impressive at the beginning of the show, just, a hard to watch game. But, again, this isn't new. I think the Midsummer Classic, we tend to think of as the best of the National League, the best of the American League, all these players who never see each other, which, of course, isn't the case anymore. I think it is now the Midsummer Classic of giving baseball fans a reason to really complain, as opposed to what we do much of the season anyway, because it, again, just isn't geared toward anybody who really cares about the game. And I imagine you could make people who are just tuning in to see baseball care about baseball, as opposed to, I didn't realize I was missing out on such a great sport, but now that I'm seeing the dark pants in action, sign me up for season tickets. Sign me up to stream and black me out wherever I live of the games I really want to be. I again, maybe this is all part of some grand plan to make this thing go extinct, because that's all I can come up with. But the National League did win, so we're technically happy.
The fact that Spencer Strider, Met fans might not like him, but he's probably the best pitcher in the game. But he didn't pitch in the game because he pitched on Saturday for the Braves, so he couldn't pitch on Tuesday. And we've talked about this on the show. Make the All-Star game on Wednesday so everybody can pitch. Remember one year, Jacob deGrom was pitching on Sunday. There was an issue. Should the Mets hold him out so he can pitch in the All-Star game or some nonsense about that? Why is this an issue every year? It's supposed to be a showcase for the best players in the game. Move it to Wednesday.
Yeah, otherwise, why are you inviting players to play in a game? I mean, listen, I think it's great when if they're injured or something, but they show up anyway. They show the colors or whatever you want to call it. I think that's nice. But yeah, you should fill rosters with eligible players who can help the team win. And if somebody pitched on the weekend, by Wednesday, theoretically, they should be able to get a batter if needed. Then again, in ye old days, starters went 3 innings, so you didn't need that many pitchers. Hey, listen, I was happy to see Kodai Senga make it. I don't think we discussed Kodai Senga at all as a possibility, but he came on very strong. And there's probably a marketing element to saying, look at this charismatic character from Japan who not only pitches well, but shows the international appeal of the game. Wouldn't it be great to have him in Seattle with everybody else? But he couldn't pitch. They basically said, oh, he needs to rest up because, as we know, Kodai Senga needs lots of rest between starts. So, with all due respect, what was he doing there if there was never any intention of using him? I'm glad we had an extra all-star, and that's great. But I don't really understand how these things are pieced together. They kept naming injury replacements, or he's not going to be able to make it replacements throughout the week preceding the game. I was leaving Monday and Tuesday open in case I had to fly to Seattle because I had an inkling that I might be somewhere down the list, maybe somewhere behind Tyler McGill if they got really desperate for an extra pitcher. But they didn't call me. I don't know if they called Tyler.
I'll always place you ahead of Tyler McGill, Greg.
Appreciate it.
Senga was even doing interviews during the game, talking about how he wasn't going to pitch. So we knew that. Plus, there weren't going to be extra innings. So I don't know how many pitchers you really needed. But as you said, there's a marketing aspect. I'm not complaining that a second Met made it. We didn't talk about Senga possibly being an all-star. Of course, he had that great outing against Arizona, which gave him further credentials. But Senga did not pitch in the game, and Pete Alonso did not hit in the game. I mean, he didn't hit a ball. He struck out twice, but he did make a nice play in the field. But you noted two interesting distinctions with Pete and Kodai.
Yeah, Kodai, excuse me, Pete, part of that nice double play turned from a certain Braves third baseman. We don't need to mention any more Braves, or too many of them to begin with there. Pete Alonso became the first Met to play for the National League in a winning effort in the All-Star game since 2012, since David Wright and R.A. Dickey, neither of whom has been on the team lately. So it goes to show you how long it's been. There have been 62 Mets named to All-Star teams now. 26 have played as winning members of teams. You'd think it would be more because of all those years that the National League was winning every year, but not every Met gets into an All-Star game. So it's a fairly select circle. And Kodai Senga is in an even more select circle, although not necessarily one that somebody would strive to be on. He is the 15th Met named to a National League All-Star team who either never or hasn't yet actually played in an All-Star game. One of those guys who was just happy to be there. Edwin Diaz and Starling Marte were two of those guys last year. You may remember Diaz actually stepped aside. They were going to bring him in the game, but the David Bednar on Pittsburgh had this was like the culmination of his career dreams, and Diaz sent word to the dugout like, "Please put this guy in. It's a bigger deal to him," which I thought was very classy because we love Edwin Diaz and we miss him terribly. And once in a while that'll happen. You just get guys on the team who don't make it. Some years they make it and play. Some years they're named again and they don't play. So they're not the only 15 guys who never got into an All-Star game as Mets, but they're the only ones who never, I should say, never got into one and didn't have another opportunity or didn't were not asked to be in multiple All-Star games. Pedro Martinez was named to two Met named to two National League All-Star teams as a Met. Both times he said I could use the days off, and he just didn't go. Rick Reed was named twice, and they opted not to use him twice. And but Ed Cranepool forever, All-Star Ed Cranepool, his one All-Star team, he was a spectator. He was, playing alongside or introduced alongside the Willie Mases and Hank Aarons in that era. I don't think a young Ed Cranepool could complain too much. How dare you not put me in? Eddie would never do that. So just a little extra distinction for both Kodai Senga and for Pete Alonso. And yeah, they won. I mean, it's going back to 1988 when the American League finally turned it around. National League has won seven All-Star games and tied one, because that was great. And I would say it's the fact that the National League won this game, like, well, maybe this augurs something, another turning of the tides. But you know what? They're both the same league now. They play under the same rules. They play each other all the time. Everything is very common between them. So I got a kick out of the National League winning for the first time in 11 years. But, you know, next year, half of these guys will be playing in the other league and vice versa. But again, this is Brigadoon. Let's enjoy the last of Brigadoon. Let's get ourselves worked up over the All-Star game, because by next week we'll be like, who's in the All-Star game again? Who won?
The All-Star game, as I've said before, and I still stand by it, is the worst part of All-Star week. All-Star week began with the Futures game on Saturday. Did you see it? Did anybody see it? It's a showcase game that MLB buries against their regular product. It was on Peacock, a cable channel, excuse me, a streaming service that MLB partners with, so they have to throw them a bone. Okay, but it's on Saturday night, and there are major league games on Saturday night. It's not a showcase game if you don't showcase it. Put it on Monday afternoon if you want people to watch it, or if you're going to move the All-Star game to Wednesday, put it on a separate day, but just don't put it on Saturday night. We didn't watch it. Most of us at least didn't. We didn't see Mike Vasil, who's on Syracuse, pitch for the National League in the Futures game. And on Sunday, the MLB draft, Steve Cohen has talked about beefing up the farm system with experienced college players, and the Mets went in that direction, drafting 17 college players out of 23, and a majority of them were pitchers. 16 pitchers out of the 23. The first round pick was not a pitcher. He's a shortstop out of high school, Colin Houck. We look forward to seeing him. The second pick is someone they really must like because they drafted him last year too, and he had to consent to being drafted by the Mets a second time, Brandon Sprout out of the University of Florida. The guy that interests me, Greg, is Nolan McLean, seventh round pick, because he is a two-way player. The Mets drafted him. The authorities, the scouts say he's a better pitcher than hitter, but he's got a lot of power. And the Mets say, let's see what he can do. So he's going to DH in the minors as well as pitch. I think that's going to be interesting. We may not ever see Otani in a Mets uniform, but we may have our own two-way player in Nolan McLean.
Fellas, sign your contracts, get a fair deal, get up here as soon as you can, and then I will learn your names.
As for the Mets, Sunday concluded the first half of the regular season, and it's not the first half. They played 90 games already with 72 to go, so it's a figurative first half, and Sunday was as disappointing a loss as they've had this season. It was an important game. Ronnie told us that before the game. We knew it was an important game. It was the difference between winning 7 of 8 and having the 6-game winning streak feel like an aberration. It was the difference between having momentum and confidence and having neither of those. We had an alleged big game pitcher on the mound, and he failed. This game was the difference between, are you saying there's a chance, and who can we trade? And it was not the way to enter the All-Star break. Greg, you wrote after that game at Faith and Fear and Flushing, to quote the commercial we've talked about at length on this show, we are not going anywhere. Do you still feel that way?
No, no way. There's, you watch two consecutive games at the end of a quote-unquote first half that take all the air out of what little hope you were puffing up in your mind from the aforementioned 6-game winning streak. You look at the standings, you're behind almost everybody. You're behind where you would need to be in the playoffs by a lot. So, you know, as fans, we'll take the slightest sign in the opposite direction of hope, and we will make the most of it. So I'm not telling you that if they were to come out of the break playing very well and winning a bunch of games, I wouldn't say, well, wait a minute, there's still time, because, you know, that's what we do. Any possible chance, but I don't see it. What was there to see? And again, you know, it's, you can say about any game, it's one game, but there are 48 games like that in the first 90 in one respect or another. And, you know, take a nice long All-Star break and don't rush back was kind of my thinking as the so-called first half was coming to an end. And you know what, once they start playing again, of course, yay, the Mets are playing. I'm so excited. But you know, show me, show us, show high. It's you know, it's still the same season. And if you know, again, if you want to get excited when they next win two games in a row, knock wood that they do that soon, I welcome you. If you want to invoke, you gotta believe 1973, you're more than welcome. I've written off seasons later than this, after which the Mets got it in gear and gave us a very good show. I can think three times in the century, 01, 16, and 19, where I wrote twice on the blog and once to friends. Forget it. Don't even bring up 1973. It's an insult to the memory of 1973. And 16, they made the playoffs. And 01, they took it to the last week. And 19, they took it at least to about the second to last weekend, I think, and made us crazy with excitement for a little while. And there again, this is the best thing to have a freezing cold takeover. You want to be proven 100% wrong when you've said, ah, season's over, they're terrible, my team. But right now, they're not very good, my team. And so all they can do is all I've asked of them throughout this is play better. And that was not what they did the last 2 days of their stay in San Diego. Hopefully that is the aberration. We will be proven wrong, but not a lot to get excited about coming into the break.
If you want to look at the numbers, the Mets are seven back of the final wild card. The Fangraphs stat is 15%. It was 14% before they won six games in a row. It's improved to 15% chance of making the playoffs, and there are five teams ahead of them. Just to get to 87 wins, let's say that's the right number. We don't know, but just to get to 87 wins, they'd have to go 45 and 27 the rest of the way. I'm not saying that's impossible, but it's hard to see it. And I have to point out, as I've talked about Buck a lot on this show, we've talked about Buck a lot, but I've talked a lot about Buck's questionable decisions. On Sunday, after one pitch, he used up his challenge. One pitch, there was the foul ball that was against the screen. The third baseman caught it. Buck thought it hit the fence first. And or the reverse. I'm trying to forget it, but I'm recalling it for the show. And Buck challenged the play after one pitch. It was a foul ball. So what happened there is that Buck stopped the game after one pitch. And we know that Max is a bit of a diva. He's earned it, but he is a bit of a diva. So that threw off his timing after one pitch, and you know that couldn't have been good for him. He should have been able to overcome it. He didn't, but he should have been, but it did throw off his timing. Buck wasted his challenge after one pitch, a foul ball. It wasn't like it was a close play at third. And it shows again Buck's questionable in-game decision making.
I have this image now, Max Scherzer as a diva that Felix Unger wants him to be the special guest at his opera club, excuse me. And he knows that Oscar knows him because Oscar covers Max Scherzer. And hilarity ensues as Max Scherzer, the diva, comes over to 1049 Park Avenue. Yeah, don't use up that challenge so quickly, Buck, unless you've got it down pat. And yeah, Max, maybe you're available for a home run derby to help Pete out next year, because you certainly helped Manny Machado giving up the home runs. That's it's a low blow, but you know, it's the last game we saw. We're talking about this days later. We have nobody else to beat up on besides Rob Manfred. So you know, play better, manage better, et al.
If Max came over for an opera event at Felix and Oscar's apartment, maybe they'd get some good press with Howard Cosell.
Howard Cosell does not frequent Felix Unger's Opera Club any longer. He's had enough of that inane drone.
But we do have Greg Cosell, his grandson, in the Mets and PA booth.
Colin Cosell.
Colin Cosell, excuse
Oh.
me. Colin Cosell in the PA booth for half the games. If you want something positive, let's be positive here. The Mets have 72 games remaining on their schedule. 42 are at home. That's a majority. 42 out of 72 will be at Citi Field, and they have no trips past the Central Time Zone. So we there are so, there is something to be said as a factor in their favor. Let's talk about who played well in the first half. This is going to be a short discussion. Let's start with Francisco Alvarez. I think we, as of now, have our catcher of the future.
Sounds like something out of the Jetsons. Yes, our catcher of the future is our catcher of the present. 17 home runs, I believe. I could envision him winning next year's home run derby while I was watching Pete Knott win this year's home run derby. Just the excitement of seeing Francisco Alvarez in that sort of atmosphere. The idea of it sent me back to 2019 when when Pete Alonso was new on the scene and was soaking up the attention and the excitement. So, that's not really the idea here. The idea is an everyday catcher who can fill the middle of the order. And ain't Francisco Alvarez all that right now? We seem to be in something of a burgeoning golden age for young catchers. So it'll be fascinating to watch Francisco stake his claim to possibly all-star berths in the future. And again, that's gravy. The meat of it all is the fact that, this guy's a stud and he's showing it. And it's one of those situations where we heard his name for a few years. We heard conflicting scouting reports on what he was capable of defensively and offensively in terms of his timeline. And here he is coming through most nights. Here he is having gone through what felt like a pretty bad slump, and he's shaken that off. And he's back, baby. And he is, if not the highlight of the first half, definitely maybe the one Met you actually want to see in the second half. If the rest of them took off for parts unknown for the next few months, would you really miss them? But Alvarez, you really do want to see.
If the second name that I'm mentioning is a positive, is Grant Harwig, you know it hasn't been a good first half of the season, but he's pitched well. And Brett Beatty has shown some signs. He looks like the third baseman of the future. And of course, Kodai Senga, I hope that he can adapt to a five-man rotation rather than the once a week that he's used to. Any other positives from the first half?
I don't know. There were good games. There were tiny stretches, those five in a row against Cleveland and Tampa Bay, or actually Tampa Bay and Cleveland, where I thought they were about to take off. The six in a row we mentioned a little before the All-Star break. And, now and then, some classic vintage type starts from your Scherzers and your Verlanders. There's not enough of them. A decent, for the most part, showing by David Robertson and Adam Ottavino in a less than ideal setting for what was envisioned for the bullpen. And, Pete hit a lot of home runs. That's why he was in the All-Star game. He kind of slacked off. I don't slacked off. I mean, he wasn't trying, but his pace slacked off. Individually, things to watch. Some nights, Brandon Nimmo, weren't we talking him up for the All-Star game? And Francisco Lindor, neither one of them got over that particular hump, but they've both been super professional and at the higher level of their position, and you're not being cheated when you watch them. And again, I feel like I'm sort of turning the corner onto that. Well, they're also good. Why are they so bad? But as much as it's swell to list individual achievements when it's not in service to what has been a collective success, it's hard to get too excited about it. So I guess the question is, do we see anything coming up from that? Anything coalescing, anything gelling? And honestly, that is to be determined.
They've lost a lot of one-run games, and statisticians will say that evens out. So we hope that happens. And really, the second half can't be much worse than the first half.
Oh, are you daring them?
I dare you, Mets, have a worse second half than the first half. So the trade deadline's coming up, and we keep hearing the Mets have both scenarios available. Do they add? Do they subtract? My guess is that after the trade deadline, Billy says, we improved for this year and next year. That'll be the way he splits it. Omar Narváez doesn't need to be re on the team anymore. Nothing against him, but he was there to be a starter and he's not a starter. We're going to hear about talk about whether Tommy Pham should be traded. He's their best hitter as of the moment. Daniel Vogelback, I don't think too many people would be upset about that. Marcana. The Mets have a team option. I like Marcana. I hope that they can work something out with him. He can play first base a little bit, third base a little bit, and the outfield. I can see him having a bench role in 2024. Ottavino's under contract for next year, but he could be traded. And Robertson's contract expires. What I like to see is Robertson be re-signed so that next year he can fulfill the role that he was hired to do, which is to pitch the eighth inning in advance of Diaz. But he could also be traded. So we have the trade deadline coming up at the end of the month.
You know, I've so put the Mets, other than the two who are on the All-Star team, out of my mind. I totally forgot about Tommy Pham. He had a terrific first half. He should have been the first name out of our mouths, at or at least up there with Alvarez and Grant Hartwig. Okay, hot take. I don't care what they do at the trade deadline. I don't mean that in a in a conceptual sense, and I don't mean it in a situational sense. I mean, this team has made me not care in that regard. It's sort of like the draft. The Mets will be here. So I'm not excited to talk about next year whatsoever. That this year, I would like them to get better. These are the guys I'm rooting for. Again, if they make some trades, if they make trade this reliever or that outfielder, I hope it works out. But I just can't get excited about the topic. I understand why it's a topic. I understand why people get interested, and they could come in and do something amazing. And I will say, thank, what a great trade deadline this was. I'm sorry.
No, Yoenis Cespedes is not walking through the door after the trade deadline.
Wouldn't that be great if he was, though? I mean, just for the hell of it.
He could come in on a horse.
Let's see. He Yoenis is, I think, 37, will be 38 in the offseason. He played in the World Baseball Classic. You don't think that, like, if Yoenis Cespedes really put his mind to it, like a couple of weeks in the cage, you brought him back as a DH or something, he couldn't do more than Vogelbach is doing most days? I don't think so. I don't think that's a problem.
Well, before we go, let's open up the NL team mailbag. We recently had a show that was very well received. They're all well received. This one was more well received than others, where Greg had the second chance All-Stars and he got a response to our ballot.
Yeah, we as you'll remember, we talked about who could have been an all-star those years that wasn't, and I posted a corresponding ballot, if you will, on Faith and Fear and Flushing, and one of people who reads the blog and listens to the podcast, Michael in California, you've met him before, was kind enough to not only send along his choices, but gave me a nice overview at each position and why he was making his picks. I will just share with you where he had a different pick from either one of us or both of us, because it's another voice and another way of looking at things. Yeah, he looks at second base differently. He said Doug Flynn here for his Gold Glove defense. Can't overlook the offense though. Wally and Felix, that's backing to me on slap singles hitters, but Wally's OPB, OP, can I say it correctly? Maybe. OBP, on base percentage, was much higher. Not a big fan of Jeff Kent's defense, no better than Bachman's, but at least he homered now and again. Jeffries, your pick, had extra base power. The man gives his nod to Wally Bachman for getting on base ahead of Mex Kid and Straw. So Wally Bachman is now a theoretical Met All-Star to join your pick, Greg Jeffries, my pick, Felix Mion. And again, all of us, we have the All-Stars in our minds. Those years are past. The important thing is we've decided they're All-Stars. Three more positions. Catcher. John Buck's power was all in the spring, which helps for same year consideration. Travis d'Arnaud's legacy is tarnished by his underachieved Met. Michael is very clever. Underachieved Met from 2018 to 2019, hampered by injury and head missing from game performance. It may be unfair to hold this bias against him, but screw him for doing so well as a Braves player. Huzzah, Michael. Sasser and Ramos were fine hitters for average. I'd have to give the nod to John Buck for holding together a patchwork pitching staff and providing some power until he was traded. So I had d'Arnaud for the All-Star who never was because I always wanted him to be one. You had Mackie Sasser, who you thought got kind of a bum reputation, but now we have three All-Star catchers to go with our chosen All-Star catchers, which there are a lot of. Left field, all five were impressive power hitters. Michael writes, Frank Thomas did have the help of the close Polo Ground outfield walls down the lines. Floyd and Gilkey, as gaudy as their stats were, might have had the help of PEDs. So my man Michael bringing the controversy, but he's era appropriate in even bringing that in. I don't know anything about Gilkey and Floyd being in that realm. Kevin McReynolds was an MVP candidate, a down year for offense. He wins. Hey, I'm not going to argue with that. And nor would Kevin McReynolds, because he wouldn't open his mouth. And finally, center field. Tommy Agee has a sentimental advantage being a Miracle Met. His chief competitors were Mookie and Lenny. The other two didn't have the offensive careers we like with the Mets. Both 80s outfielders were fast and clutch, but Mookie's advantage in stolen bases is offset by Lenny's greater on-base ability. This is a toss-up, so we'll give it to the 86 world champion center fielder Dykstra. But regarding who had it and has it more together as a person, Mookie wins. Hands down. And you're never going to argue with Mookie Wilson as a choice for anything, even though Lenny gets the all-star nod here. And again, let's remind our listeners, Tommy Agee and Mookie Wilson and Rusty Staub, three Mets in the Hall of Fame, the team's Hall of Fame, who were never all-stars as Mets. I think that makes them all-stars forever in our minds. So I want to thank Michael for taking the time to give us his thoughts, to listen to the show. And everybody who weighed in, who wanted to let me know, for example, that where was Skip Lockwood? And, you know, as I said, Skip Lockwood just missed the cut on the ballot. We limited it to five apiece. But this was a fun exercise to execute. And I'm really happy to know that there's some people who really got into the spirit of it.
We thank Michael for his response. And if you want to get in touch with the show, we're at nationalleaguetown@gmail.com. And we thank you for listening. We'll be back next week as Greg takes us back to 1993. So until then, I'm Jeff Heisen.
I'm Greg Prince.
And as always, let's go Mets. Copyright 2023, music provided by the Royal Arctic Institute. Check them out on Spotify.